Well, today I am very excited for you, actually, because I have something quite remarkable that I get to share with all of you today. Kind of just to wow you a little bit on this holy day. Underneath this blanket right here is one of the most remarkable, one of the most powerful, one of the most elegant instruments in the entire orchestra. Now, I don't know when the last time you've been to a major performance, like at the National Symphony Orchestra or something like that, but you might consider it your lucky day if they break out this instrument. And perhaps you even booked that specific performance so that you could see this specific instrument. And if you did, well, I wouldn't blame you one bit. This guy is majestic. But before we reveal this instrument, and when thinking about how truly big and powerful things can be, it's impossible not to consider how big and how awesome God truly is. And one way that God shows his power is through his creation and the many signs and wonders he has performed. I mean, he has created whole galaxies, so that's not too shabby, I don't think. And he's created whole star systems that have come together, maybe gone off in a supernova and reformed again in other systems, all without a single human eye ever laying eyes on them. He's created and designed and implemented thoughts and plans that we can't even comprehend. God, after all, is the God of big things, huge things. I'd like to start out today by turning to a couple of examples and reading through them together. There are so many examples that we can really only just blitz through a couple of them. But I think it's important to set the stage for us to today and get our minds focused on God, who is, in fact, God of big things. Let's go back to Luke chapter 7. Luke chapter 7. Again, there's so many astounding examples that we could use. I want to go to Luke chapter 7 and read verses 11 through 16. Luke chapter 7, verses 11 through 16. It said, "Now it happened the day after." This was after Jesus Christ healed the centurion servant, if you remember that story. "Now it happened the day after that he went into the city called Nain, and many of his disciples went with him, and a large crowd. And when he came near the gate of the city, behold, a dead man was being carried out, the only son of his mother, and she was a widow. And a large crowd from the city was with her. And when the Lord saw her, he had compassion on her, and said to her, 'Do not weep.' And he came, and he touched the open coffin, and those who carried him stood still. And he said, 'Young man, I say to you, arise.'" Now, this is one of three instances, at least three, that Jesus Christ raises someone from the dead. It's hard to imagine anything bigger than this, right? Verse 15, "So he who was dead sat up and began to speak, and he presented him to his mother. And then fear came upon them all." I imagine so. "And they glorified God, saying, 'A great prophet has risen up among us, and God has visited his people.'" God is the God of big things. Imagine how that family felt every time they saw this individual that was raised from the dead. As he walked around the neighborhood, as he went about his life, every time someone saw him, they would remember this powerful, incredible miracle. And there are many other examples where Jesus Christ uses a big display of power. And sometimes it's easy to skip over them because Jesus Christ, he doesn't flaunt this power, but yet he uses it as a tool to help accomplish his purpose. Turn with me forward a few chapters to John chapter 21. John chapter 21. This is after Jesus Christ's death and his resurrection. And the disciples are floundering a little bit in this passage, and Christ goes to show himself to them and to rejuvenate them. And I want to pick it up in verse 3 of John chapter 21. John chapter 21 and verse 3. Simon Peter said to them, "I am going fishing." and said to him, "We are also going with you also." And they went out and immediately got into the boat, and that night they caught nothing. So again, the disciples weren't really sure what to kind of do with themselves after Christ had died. They were a little listless, a little directionless. And when Christ originally came into their life, it really turned their whole life upside down. And then after he died, it kind of turned it upside down once again. And maybe they were confused. Maybe they were discouraged. Maybe they didn't know what really to do next. So they might as well go back to what they knew. Might as well take the boats out and go fishing again. Verse 4. But when the morning had now come, Jesus stood on the shore, yet the disciples did not know that it was Jesus. And then Jesus said to them, "Children, have you any food?" And they answered him, "No." And he said to them, "Cast the net on the right side of the boat, and you will find some." And so they cast, and now they were not able to draw it in because of the multitude of fish. Let's drop down to verse 11. Simon Peter went up and dragged the net to the land full of large fish, 153. And although there were so many, the net was not broken. Now think about what had happened here and all the laws of nature that Jesus Christ just cast aside to make this happen. Now these were professional fishermen, and they had spent the whole night without catching a fish. So it's not like they didn't know what to look for or something like that. And he says, just throw them on the other side of your boat. And when they did, it was immediately filled to the brim. And one commentary said that in verse 11, they mentioned the exact number of fish because fishermen, as we know, tend to exaggerate. And so the writer wanted to make sure it was absolutely clear. This was the real deal. This was a supernatural event that was filled to the brim. And not only was that crazy, but the nets held as well. So it was not only enough to bend the laws of nature to get the fish into the net, but then Jesus Christ had to strengthen the net as well. It's really no big deal to the creator of the universe, right? God is the God of big things. There's no doubt about that. Now, one other example, and I don't think we could pass over these days without going there, is in Exodus chapter 14. Exodus chapter 14. Hopefully we've been recounting this story as we've been leading up to these holy days, but also, I'll do the sheets, the holy days, but the just to recount, the Israelites were slaves, and God decides to go and free them. And of course, the Egyptians didn't want to let them go, at least not at first, and God brings plagues across the whole country to demonstrate his power. 10 different plagues, all massive in their scale, each one showing that he had a command over all of the elements. Each one a direct contradiction to the power that the Egyptians thought their gods had. And finally, after the death of the firstborn, the Egyptians, they relent and they let them go, only to then immediately regret it. Let's pick up the story in verse 5 of Exodus chapter 14. Again, that's Exodus chapter 14 and verse 5. It says, "Now it was told the king of Egypt that the people had fled, and the hearts of Pharaoh and his servants was turned against the people. And they said, 'Why have we done this, that we have let Israel go from serving us?'" Verse 6. "So he made ready his chariot and took his people with him. Also he took 600 choice chariots and all the chariots of Egypt with captains over every one of them. And the Lord hardened the heart of Pharaoh, king of Egypt, and he pursued the children of Israel. And the children of Israel went out with boldness. So the Egyptians pursued them, all the horses and the chariots of Pharaoh, his horsemen and his army, and overtook them, camping by the sea beside these two cities." Verse 10. "And when Pharaoh drew near, the children of Israel lifted their eyes, and behold, the Egyptians marched after them. So they were very afraid, and the children of Israel cried out to the Lord." So God had just performed these huge miracles just leading up to this event, but he wasn't done, was he? Dropping down to verse 19, still in Exodus 14, verse 19. "And the angel of God who went before the camp of Israel moved and went behind them. And the pillar of cloud went from before them and stood behind them So it came between the camp of the Egyptians and the camp of Israel. Thus it was a cloud and darkness to one, and it gave light by night to the other, so that the one did not come near the other all that night. So God is supernaturally shielding the Israelites here from the approaching Egyptians. Verse 21. And then Moses stretched out his hand over the sea, and the Lord caused the sea to go back by a strong east wind all that night, and made the sea into dry land, and the waters were divided. So the children of Israel went into the midst of the sea on the dry ground, and the waters were a wall to them on their right hand and on their left. Miracle after miracle. Now, if you've ever tried to even just stop up a small little creek in your backyard as a child, you'll know that this is a miracle that only God could perform. Because again, God is the God of big things. Even the most well-designed dam that the planet could put together could not have left a wall of water on both the left and the right-hand side. And there is nothing that God could not do if he wanted to, because God is the God of big things. But sometimes there's a problem. The problem is not with God, obviously, but it's a problem with us human beings. Big things, as remarkable and as noteworthy as they are, well, they don't always have a very lasting impact. Now, by definition, they are big, and they are amazing, and they blow people away, and they can bring people to tears, and they can drive people to raise up their hands and shout, "Hallelujah!" And maybe in modern times, they might blog about it or tweet about it. And it can often be so big that someone's life can be defined by this event, as in what their life was before this happened and what their life became afterwards. And when these events and these miracles permanently change someone's life for the better, how wonderful is that? But all too often, when the excitement fades, life just kind of goes back to normal and how it was before. And the big can sometimes become the distant, and the distant can sometimes become the forgotten. The Israelites, they crossed through the Red Sea on dry ground. They saw one of the most powerful armies in the known world perish right before their very eyes. But as you know, in a couple of days, they were back to complaining. The disciples, they walked with Christ. They learned from Christ. They lived with Christ. And after he died, well, they went back fishing. And Jesus healed one person after another. But then, of course, the people turned right on him, didn't they? Over and over and over and over again, you can see this with the Israelites as the same cycle repeats itself generation after generation. A problem would pop up. God would miraculously deliver them. They would be so thankful. They would go and slaughter a record number of sheep. But then time would go on. They would fall back into their sinful ways. They would forget what God had done for them. And the cycle goes and repeats itself right back over again. Even we saw it right with the Israelites right as they crossed through the Red Sea. As soon as they set foot on the other side and they started to get this supernatural manna from heaven, a miracle every single day, supernatural manna. Even then they complained because they didn't have any meat. Those big things, those miracles, those ginormous actions and wonders, they didn't have any staying power. They didn't have a lasting impact. And you can almost see this play out in real time in 1 Kings chapter 18. I'd like to go there. 1 Kings chapter 18. I'd like to revisit this story. It's one of my favorite stories. And this is in the time of Elijah. And although I think we could go back and really kind of dig into this context, I think you already know the theme of what happens here. The Israelites keep going back to Baal and idolatry, and Elijah finally kind of sets up this big confrontation between the false prophets of Baal and himself, and kind of a test of sacrifices. It's a sacrifice off. And God is going to perform an amazing wonder through Elijah. I want to pick it up in verse 21 of 1 Kings chapter 18. 1 Kings 18, verse 21. And Elijah came to all the people and said, "How long? How long will you falter between two opinions? If the Lord is God, well, follow him. But if Baal, well, follow him." But the people answered him not a word. Then Elijah said to the people, "I alone am left a prophet of the Lord, but Baal's prophets are 450 men. Therefore, let them give us two bulls, and let them choose one bull for themselves, cut it in pieces, lay it on the wood, but put no fire under it. And I'll prepare the other bull, I'll lay it on the wood, but I'll put no fire under it. And then you shall call on the name of your gods, and I will call on the name of the Lord. And the God who answers by fire, he is God." So all the people answered and said, "It is well spoken." Okay, so we have the terms of the engagement here, that both sides, they agree to these conditions. The false prophets, as you know, they do their thing. They prep up their animal. They dance around. They cut themselves. They do kind of whatever they think they need to do. But nothing happens. And Elijah then, he goes to prepare his. Let's go down to verse 32. It says, "Then with stones he built an altar in the name of the Lord. And he made a trench around the altar large enough to hold two seas of seed. And he put the wood in order. He cut the bull in pieces. And he laid it on the wood. And he said, 'Fill four water pots with water.'" Okay, that's a little counterproductive here. "Pour it on the burnt sacrifice and on the wood." Then he said, "Do it a second time." And they did it a second time. And he said, "Do it a third time." And they did it a third time. Keep going. Just soak the whole thing. So water ran all around the altar, and he also filled the trench with water. Well, of course, you know what happened here. Drop down to verse 38. "Then the fire of the Lord fell and consumed the burnt sacrifice and the wood and the stones and the dust, and it licked up the water that was in the trench." You could dump gallons of water on this thing. Elijah could have put this in the bottom of the ocean. That wouldn't have made one bit of difference to our God. He's the creator of the universe. He doesn't have to listen to laws of physics. God's the giver of life. God's the giver of all things. He's the God of big things. And of course, this did wow the crowd. They got all fired up, and they went and they took action. They got rid of those false prophets. They recommitted themselves right back to God, and it gave them the shakeup that they needed. And seeing fire come down from heaven, well, how could it not? But you do know the story, right? It was very short-lived. It barely put a dent in the leadership of the day. They were stubborn as always. And the rest of the people, they forgot quickly. They returned back to their previous ways. Even Elijah, through whom God performed all these amazing signs and wonders, even Elijah was a little despondent. It was big, but it was fleeting. And I think God knew the tendency of human beings to behave in this way, which is why God is not only the God of big things, but God is the God of small things, too. And God can use small things in life to have just as much as, and sometimes much more, of an impact on a person's life. Now, not just to shock them and awe them, not just to kind of hit this giant reset button, but rather to strike down at the foundation of their soul, right down to the core of that person, and to just strike a note that can last forever. Small things, like well-timed questions from a friend, like a scripture that we've read 100 times, and when we go back over it the 101st, it hits in a slightly different way. Maybe it's an open door that appeared at the perfect time. Or maybe it's a closed door that shuts also at the perfect time. Maybe it's an observation you make in a person that you admire. Maybe it's a quiet reflection you have about yourself. God is the God of those things too. And God has that ability to cut through the noise of life and deliver a powerful, undeniable, everlasting impact. God is the God of big things, and he's the God of small things. And only through his amazing wisdom can he masterfully weave them together as effectively as he does. And that brings us back to this little guy right here. As I mentioned before, it's one of the most powerful instruments in the entire orchestra. Are you ready to see what it is? This was not part of it. Behold, it's actually inside the box, so give me 1 second here. It's this guy. Now, I know what you're thinking. How did Mike manage to track down this majestic beast of an instrument? What kind of strings did he have to pull, pun intended, to get this bad boy here up on the stage? Now, hypothetically speaking, there might be one or two of you that in the back of your mind, you're thinking, well, wait a second, this is just a triangle. It doesn't look all that amazing. Now, if you're thinking that, well, we'll forgive you. Because now it is true. This is not a tuba. It's not a cymbal. It's not a loud instrument. Nor is it a physically big instrument. But there are times within a performance where a different kind of effect is needed. And they need something powerful, but not powerful in terms of volume, but in terms of impact. And from that perspective, I like to propose to you that this simple triangle here is one of the most powerful pieces in the entire orchestra, and that its power comes from the impact that it can make, not from its size or for its noise level. James Blades of the Groove Dictionary of Music and Musicians wrote, "The triangle is by no means a simple instrument to play." Now, I want you to think here just for a second. The triangle, it sits with the rest of the percussion instruments way in the back of the orchestra. And this tiny little piece of metal has to outperform to the point where people way in the back, even back in the cheap seats where I'd be sitting, way in the back, maybe even an audience of 2,000 or 3,000 people, and they still have to be able to hear this sound. And that is by no means an easy feat. At the National Symphony Orchestra, depending on the performance, they can have 90 different performers playing instruments. They could have up to 6 different people just blasting away on the horns. And through all that cacophony of sounds, this little instrument still has the ability to cut right through the noise and deliver a very powerful, distinct sound right to your ears. Even though it's small, this little guy can make quite an impact. Now, I have a couple of audio examples I want to demonstrate and share with you today. Now, I want you to close your eyes just for a moment. You don't have to do it, but it works a lot better if you close your eyes. And I want you just to imagine that you are in the audience of this symphony. And there's other instruments playing, big instruments, ginormous instruments, loud instruments. But even with all of them blasting away, I want to see if you can pick out our little instrumental hero here in the score. The first clip I have is from Respighini's Fountains of Rome with the conductor Scott Bean and the Hart Symphony Orchestra. And within this, I picked 2 different parts of this same piece. One's from the very beginning. And then one is towards the end where our poor triangle has to outperform a trumpet. So the first one is Respighini's Fountains of Rome.
Thank you.
is from the ending part. Remarkable, right? I mean, you could hear it even over the sound of a trumpet. There was a piano in there. There was about a million string instruments in that particular piece. But even so, cutting through all that noise, you could hear the triangle. I have one more piece. This one is Liszt Piano Concerto No. 1, the third movement. And see if you're able to pick out the triangle in this one. It's maybe not quite as subtle as the one before. Be a physically small instrument, it does have the unique ability to cut through the rest of the noise and deliver a powerful, undeniable impact within the score. Compared to the cello or the double upright bass, this guy is comparatively quite small. But pound for pound, it packs a mean punch. And used within the right way, it can be an incredibly effective instrument within the orchestra. Now, keeping this theme in mind, I want to continue on in the next chapter of 1 Kings, this time in chapter 19. We're going to continue our story of Elijah because we've seen the God of big things execute big miracles. Now we're going to see the God of small things change tactics and come at Elijah in a slightly different way. I'd like to pick it up in verse 9 of chapter 19. Again, this is after the sacrifice contest, after the prophets of Baal were slain, and after Jezebel threatens Elijah, and he flees away from Jerusalem into the desert. And this is where we'll pick up the story. 1 Kings 19, verse 9. And there he went into a cave, that's Elijah, and spent the night in that place. And behold, the word of the Lord came to him, and he said to him, "What are you doing here, Elijah?" Verse 10, so he said, "I have been very zealous for the Lord God of hosts, for the children of Israel have forsaken your covenant, torn down your altars, and killed your prophets with a sword. I alone am left, and they seek to take my life." Now Elijah, he's down, he's out, but notice how God combines the big and the small with his interactions with Elijah. Now, it's more exaggerated in this example that we're reading here, but God does the exact same thing in our lives as well. Verse 11, and then he, this is God obviously, said, "Go out and stand on the mountain before the Lord. And behold, the Lord passed by, and a great and strong wind tore into the mountains." I mean, this is big stuff. "And broke the rocks into pieces before the Lord. But the Lord was not in the wind. And after the wind, an earthquake, but the Lord was not in the earthquake." All of these are huge things. God, of course, has power over fire and earthquakes and wind. These are trivial things to God. Of course, he has control over them and everything else. Verse 12, "And after the earthquake, a fire, but the Lord was not in the fire. And after the fire, a still, small voice. And so it was when Elijah heard it, that he wrapped his face in his mantle, and he went out, and he stood in the entrance of the cave. And suddenly a voice came to him and said, 'What are you doing here, Elijah? What are you doing here?'" There is a tremendous amount of power in big things. these miracles and signs and wonders that God commands, there is no doubt great power and majesty in them. He can shape the course of human history. He can move mountains. He can dry up the sea. He can bring fire down from heaven. He can turn a human into a pillar of salt. He can raise the dead back to life. Tremendous power, far beyond what us mere mortals could ever accomplish. God is the God of big things. But God is also the God of small things. And here he can ask a simple question that hits harder than any of the miracles Elijah just did. What are you doing here, Elijah? What are you doing here, Mike? Is this who you want to be? There is also a tremendous amount of power in the things that are small, the things that are quiet, maybe not as flashy as others, but strike down to the core of an individual. Power is not in the magnitude, it's in the impact. Power is not in the magnitude, it's in the impact. And God's power comes in many forms, in many methods, but all with the same goal, to have an impact within our lives. And thinking about it in these terms, let's turn our focus back now to the days of unleavened bread, this holy day. This festival, these days, God combines both the big and the small, and he designed it that way from the very beginning. I know we already read part of the story of the Israelites coming out of Egypt, but let's continue back there in Exodus chapter 12. Exodus chapter 12, I want to pick it up in verse 17. Exodus chapter 12 and verse 17. It says, "So you shall observe the feast of unleavened bread, for on the same day I will have brought your armies out of the land of Egypt." That's a big thing. "Therefore you shall observe this day throughout your generations as an everlasting ordinance. And in the first month, on the 14th day of the month at evening, you shall eat unleavened bread." That's a small thing. "Until the 21st day of the month at evening. For 7 days no leaven shall be found in your houses. Since whoever eats what is leaven, that same person shall be cut off from the congregation of Israel, whether he is a stranger or a native of the land. You shall eat nothing unleavened. In all your dwellings you shall eat unleavened bread." Now, it's quite the contrast where on one hand you're talking about the parting of the Red Sea, and on the other hand you're talking about this little microorganism that floats in the air and leavens bread. A tiny little fungus that converts sugar molecules that you can't really see and changes it into carbon dioxide, which you can't really see. But in weaving both the big and the small together, God gave the Israelites multiple ways to connect themselves, both as a nation and as an individual, back to their deliverer and back to their God. And as we fast forward to our time today, some of the intricacies of the holy day have changed from when the Israelites fled Egypt, but the mechanics of how the day is celebrated each year work in the same way. We are still to recount the big and the wonderful things that God has done and how he has intervened in our lives. And we are still to consider these big concepts, like how to seek out and remove sin from our lives. But we're also to focus on the little things too, like eating unleavened bread, by removing the small thoughts before they can blossom even further, and by adding positive fruit of the Spirit in its place. Simple things, like how do I show love to the brethren?